Chapter 10. "Where you been?" Russo asks him. Malone looks at his watch. "Noon tour? I'm on time." He's on time, but his head is fucking reeling. Booze hangover, drug hangover, sex hangover, fear hangover. They got him by the fucking balls. He doesn't know what to do. "That's not what I'm talking about," Russo says. "You haven't changed your clothes. You smell like booze, weed, and pussy. Expensive pussy, but still." "I've been at my girlfriend's," Malone says. "That okay with you?" It's the first lie. To his partner, his best friend, his brother. "Tell him," Malone thinks. "Take him and Monty out in the alley and tell him. You got your dick caught in the Pacconi thing. You're gonna work it out. They got nothing to worry about." But he doesn't. "You went to your girlfriend's?" Russo laughs. "Looking like that? How'd that go?"
"Like it looks," Malone says. "It's okay with you, Mom? I thought I'd shower here, change."
If he looks like hell, Levin looks like hell lined with shit. He's hunched over on the bench, trying to tie his shoes, but seems like too much for him. When he looks up and sees Malone, his face is white and guilty, like a perp in the room ready to go. Levin will make a good cop, Malone thinks, but he'll never be an undercover. Can't keep the guilt off his face.
"Bowling night isn't for pussies," Malone says.
"Just pussy," Russo says. "But you already know that, don't you?"
"I don't want to talk about it."
"Poor Emily,"
Russo says. "Amy. As in, don't tell Amy," Monty says.
"The fuck's the difference?" Russo says. "Don't worry, Dave. What happens in Manhattan North stays in Manhattan North. No, wait. That's Vegas. What happens in Manhattan North, we tell everybody."
Malone goes in, takes a shower, pops two go pills, changes into a blue denim shirt and black jeans. When he gets out, Russo says,
"Sykes wants to see you."
Malone goes up to the captain's office.
"You look like hell," Sykes says. "Out celebrating?"
"You should be too," Malone says. "You closed Gillette Williams, the noose is off your neck. The Post and the News have Woody's for you."
"The Amsterdam News is calling me an Oreo. You care?"
"Not really," Sykes says. But Malone knows he does.
"I'm pleased about Gillette Williams," Sykes says. "But it doesn't solve the bigger problem. In fact, it only makes it worse. If Carter gets those weapons, he'll hit back hard."
"I talked to him," Malone says.
"You did what?"
"I happened to bump into him," Malone says. "So I took the opportunity to ask him to stand down."
"And?"
"You're right. He won't." More lies of omission. He doesn't tell Sykes that he knows for a fact one of his detectives is on Carter's pad, running interference, in fact, on the gun deal. Can't tell him, because Sykes would slap Torres in cuffs. So instead, he says,
"We're on it." "You want to be a little more specific?" Sykes asks.
"We're placing a visual surveillance on 3803 Broadway, where we believe Teddy Bailey is setting up the deal."
"Can that get us Carter?"
"Probably not," Malone says. "You want the guns, or you want Carter?"
"First the one, then the other."
"We get the guns," Malone says. "Carter's going down anyway."
"I want him arrested," Sykes says. "Not killed by Carlos Castillo."
"Does it matter?" Malone asks.
"I won't have the task force perceived as operating on behalf of one drug operation versus another," Sykes says. "This is New York, not Mexico."
"Jesus Christ, Captain," Malone says. "You want these guns or you don't? We both know Devon Carter isn't going anywhere near them, just like we both know these homicide clearances are going to buy you a little time, but not a lot, before 1P is up your ass again."
"Get the guns," Sykes says. "Just be aware that your team is serving as the point of the task force spear, not a loose cannon of your own."
"Don't worry," Malone says. "When the bus goes down, you'll be in on it. You'll be there to spike the ball for the touchdown celebration, but you don't want to know how I get you to the red zone." He walks downstairs into a nasty freaking ambush. It's Claudette. Two uniforms have her by the elbows and try to move her gently out of the lobby, but she ain't having it.
"Where is he?" she says.
Where's Denny? I want to see Denny.
Malone comes through the door to see this. She's jonesing. She was high, and now she's jangling. Her nerves starting to jump ugly at her. She sees him, too.
Where have you been? I looked for you last night. I called you. You didn't answer. I came to your place. You weren't there.
Most of the uniforms look appalled and scared. A couple smirk until Monty turns his gaze on them. I got this, Malone says. He takes Claudette from the officers. Let's go outside. But she has that strength that crazy gives a person and won't budge.
Who is she? You smell like pussy, you motherfucker. White pussy? Some ratchet?
The desk sergeant leans out from the counter.
Denny, I know, I got it.
He picks Claudette up by the waist and carries her to the door as she kicks and screams.
You don't want your friends to see me, asshole? You ashamed of me in front of your cops? He fucks me, y'all. I let him fuck me in the ass when he wants, in my black ass.
Sykes is standing on the stairs, watching this. Malone wrestles Claudette out the door into the street. Plainclothes guys coming in, stare at him. Get in the car, Malone tells her.
Fuck you.
Get in the fucking car.
He shoves it through the passenger door, slams it, walks around, and gets in. Hits the lock button, rolls up her sleeves, and sees the needle mark.
Jesus, Claudette. Am I under arrest, officer?
Claudette asks.
Gosh, officer, is there something I can do to avoid going to jail?
She unzips his fly and bends over. He straightens her up. Knock it off.
Can't get it up? Your whore wear you out?
She takes her chin between his left thumb and forefinger. Listen to me. Listen to me. I cannot be having this. You cannot come here. Because you're ashamed of me. Because it is my place of work. Claudette breaks down.
I'm sorry, Denny. I got so desperate. You left me alone. You left me all alone.
It's an explanation and an accusation. He gets it. A junkie goes in the alley alone with a disease. It's the disease that walks out.
How much did you shoot?
He asks. He's scared because it's a new world out there. The dealers are mixing fentanyl with the smack. It's 40 times stronger, and if she gets a dose of that, she could OD. Junkies are dropping out there, dying like gays back in the worst of the AIDS days.
Enough, I guess,
she says, and repeats.
You left me alone, baby, and I couldn't take it, so I went out and scored.
Who fixed you? She shakes her head.
You'll hurt him.
I promise I won't. Who?
What difference does it make?
She asks.
You think you can threaten every dealer in New York?
You think I can't find out?
Then find out,
she says.
I'm hurting, baby.
He drives her home, grabs a get-well bag from under the dashboard, and brings it up with him. Go into the bedroom and shoot, he says. I don't want to watch.
It's my last, baby, she says. They'll give me some come-down shit at the hospital. I know a doctor. I'll step it down, I promise.
He sits on the sofa. If I go to jail, he thinks. She dies. She'll never make it alone. Claudette comes out a few minutes later.
Tired now. Sleepy.
Malone lays her on the sofa, goes into the bathroom, kneels down, and pukes into the toilet. He's violently sick until there's nothing left to throw up, and he dry heaves. Then he sits on the black and white tile floor, reaches up to the sink for a hand towel, and wipes the sweat off his face. After a couple minutes, he gets up, splashes cold water on his face and the back of his neck. He brushes his teeth until the vomit smell is gone. Then he takes his phone and punches in the number. Here's. Hello? Odell must have been sitting by the phone, a smug bastard, waiting, knowing I was going to cave. Malone says, I'll give you lawyers, but no cops, you hear me? I will never give you brother cops. Chapter 11. Sykes waves him upstairs the second he walks into the house. He gets up to the office. Sykes asks,
have you ever heard of rape under the color of authority?
No.
For example, Sykes says, if a person in a position of power, say a police detective, has a sexual relationship with a person under that power, say a criminal informant, that is rape under the color of authority. It's a felony. 10 years to life.
She's not a CI.
She was high.
She's not a CI, Malone repeats.
Then who is she?
Sykes asks.
That's not your business, Malone says.
when a woman causes a tawdry scene in the lobby of my station house, Sykes says. It is very much my business. I cannot have one of my detectives' personal lives embarrassing the job in public. You're married, aren't you, Sergeant Malone?
Separated.
Does this woman reside in Manhattan North?
Yeah.
So you carrying on with a woman who lives in your jurisdiction, Sykes says, is conduct unbecoming an officer. At the very least, bring charges. I will.
No, you won't, Malone says. Because I just cleared your big fucking case. Your career is back on track, and you're not going to do anything to put a negative light on your command.
Sykes stares at him.
And Malone knows he's right.
Keep your personal messes out of my station house, Sykes says. Malone and Russo cruise up Broadway north of 158th.
You want to talk about it?
Russo asks.
No, Malone says.
But you do, and you're going to, so go ahead.
A black woman with a drug problem?
Russo asks.
It's not good, Denny, particularly given the current, shall we say, sensitive racial environment.
I'll take care of it.
By which you mean you'll end it?
By which I mean I'll take care of it, Malone says.
Subject closed.
Broadway up here is broken into north and south lanes with a strip of trees in the center, and the nail shop below Carter's safe house is on the west side.
It's a second floor walk up, Russo says.
Fat Teddy can't be liking that.
Russo pulls over by an ATM on the east side of the street. They get out and pretend to take out money, but instead watch Babyface walk into the liquor store next to the nail shop. 5 minutes later, he comes out with a six-pack of Colt 45, which he passes to Montague.
Malone and Russo cross Broadway and go into a diner. 15 minutes later, Montague comes in and sits down across from Malone.
Go on, Malone says.
Say it.
What am I gonna say? Monty asks.
His eyes have mischief in them, but Malone sees the seriousness underneath.
I prefer black women, too.
That was some scene, Russo says.
I admire your taste in women, Monty says. I truly do, but with all the heat on us right now, the last thing we need is more attention.
I told Russo I'll take care of it.
And I heard you, Monty says.
On more pressing matters, the Chaldean gentleman wants to keep his liquor license. I explained that he just sold alcohol to a minor. He doesn't seem to know Carter, and I told him we just wanted to use his back storeroom for a few weeks and all is forgiven.
Malone gets up. We better get the fuck out of here. They get back into the car and watch as Levin goes in. It takes him 45 minutes, then he comes out, gets into the car, and Russo drives him out of there.
We can punch a hole in the drywall, Levin says. Push a wire up to the second floor and we've got ears on Carter's little office.
What about shifts? Russo asks. Teddy knows me, Malone, and Monty, and you can't do 24/7.
You guys are techno-Neanderthals, Levin says. Once we get the wire in, I can monitor it on my laptop anywhere close with Wi-Fi, which is like everywhere, and we don't do 24/7, just when Teddy comes in.
Nasty ass can give us that, Malone says.
Levin, you sure you're good with this?
No warrant. It's illegal as shit. We get caught, you lose your shield, maybe go to jail.
Levin smiles. Just don't tell Amy.
You coming back to the house? Russo asks Malone.
No, I have to go downtown, Malone says.
Prep for Fat Teddy's map hearing.
Good luck with that, Russo says.
Yeah. It's a stupid fucking irony of this whole thing. To make the gun case, they had to keep Fat Teddy out of jail and on the street. And if they'd known that then, they could have gotten him a walk without buying the case. And none of this federal bullshit would have happened. Now he has to buy the case to keep his own ass out of jail. He feels like he's gonna puke.
Quit feeling sorry for yourself, Malone thinks.
Man up and do what you gotta do.
Malone finds Nasty Ass Junkie bopping up Amsterdam at 133rd and pulls over.
Get in.
He'd forgotten how bad the snitch smells. Jesus, Nasty.
What?
Nasty is relaxed. Happy. He must have scored.
You ever use a toilet?
I don't have no toilet.
Borrow one,
Malone says. He rolls the windows down.
You know a nurse who used to score around here? Name is Claudette.
A sister? Real pretty?
Yeah.
I seen her.
Who does she score from?
Slinger named Frankie.
White guy?
Malone asks. Works Lincoln Playground?
That's him.
Malone gives him a 20.
White people are cheap.
That's why we have the money, Malone says. Get out.
White people rude, too.
Now I have to turn this car in, get a fresh one, Malone says.
You hurtful, man. You a hurtful motherfucker.
Call me.
Cheap, rude, and hurtful.
Out. Nasty ass gets out of the car. Frankie sits on the steel bench in the holding cell at the end of the hall. Malone picked him up and took him to 3-2, not Manhattan North. They let him sit for a while to get him jacked up. The cell stinks of piss, shit, vomit, sweat, fear, desperation, hopelessness, and a heavy dose of Axe cologne that Frankie probably lifted from Dwayne Reed. Malone opens the door and walks in. No, don't get up. Frankie's in his early 30s. His head is shaved. He has tattoo sleeves and more tats on his neck. Malone rolls up his own sleeves. Frankie sees it.
You gonna beat me up?
You remember a woman named Claudette? Malone asks. You sold her some shit today?
I guess so.
You guess, Malone says. You know she was clean. Because you hadn't seen her for a while, right?
Or she went somewhere else,
Frankie says. You a junkie too?
I use.
So you deal to pay for your own shit, Malone says.
Pretty much.
He's trembling. You know why they put you in this particular cell? Malone asks. The video camera doesn't reach. And you know how it is these days. If it's not on camera, it didn't happen.
Oh, Jesus.
Jesus isn't here, Malone says. What you got is me. And the difference between him and me is that he's a forgiving kind of guy. And I don't have an ounce of forgiveness in my entire body.
Oh, God. Did she OD?
No, Malone says. If she had, you'd have never made it to the house. Listen to me. Frankie, look up at me and listen. Frankie looks up at him. Malone says, I promised her I wouldn't hurt you. So, they're gonna cut you loose after I leave, but listen to me, Frankie. Next time you see her, you run. Don't walk in the other direction. If you ever saw her dope again, I will find you and I will beat you to death. And now you know that I keep my promises. He walks out of the cell. Chapter 12. Isabel Paz, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, is a killer. A fucking killer, Malone thinks. Caramel skin, jet black hair, red lipstick over a wide mouth and thin lips. Probably in her early 40s, but looks younger. Comes into the room in a black business jacket over a tight skirt and high heels. Dressed to kill. They're back at the fucking Waldorf. Paz made sure to arrive last. Same thing with mob guys, Malone thinks. The boss is always the last to arrive at a meeting. Make the other people wait, establish a pecking order. These fucks are no different. Old school. Malone stands up. Paz doesn't offer her hand. Just says, Isabel Paz, U.S. Attorney. Danny Malone, NYPD detective. She doesn't smile either. Just moves her skirt and sits down across from him. Have a seat, Sergeant Malone. He sits down. Weintraub starts up a digital recorder. Odell presents it with a cup of coffee like it's his balls he's offering up. Then he sits down. So we're all at the fucking table, Malone thinks. Now what? Paz says, Sergeant Malone, let me be clear. I don't think you're a hero. I think you're a criminal who takes bribes from other criminals, just so we understand each other. Malone doesn't answer. I would just as soon put you behind bars for betraying your oath, your badge, and the public trust, Paz says. But we have higher value targets to go after. That being the case, I'm just going to hold my nose and work with you. She opens a file. Let's get down to business. You'll have to make a proffer during which you will admit to any and all crimes you committed up to this moment. If you lie, by omission or commission, any arrangement we make will be null and void. If you commit any further crimes that go beyond the scope of this investigation and do not have our specific approval, any arrangement we make will be null and void. If you perjure yourself in any sworn affidavit or in testimony, any arrangement we make will be null and void. Do you understand? Malone says, I won't go after cops.
Paz looks over at Odell, and Malone sees it. He didn't tell her about that part of the deal. Odell looks across the coffee table at him.
Let's cross that bridge when we come to it.
No, Malone says. There is no bridge that goes there. Then you go to jail, Paz says. Then I go to fucking jail. And fuck you.
Do you think this is a joke, Sergeant Malone?
Paz asks. You want me to bring you lawyers? I'll hold my nose and work with you, Malone says. You ask me to work against cops? You can go fuck yourself.
Turn off the tape.
Paz snaps at Weintraub. She looks at Malone.
Maybe you have me confused with one of your usual Southern District prep school Ivy League dickwads. I'm a PR from the South Bronx. Tougher streets than you came from, Ile de Puta. I'm the middle child of six kids. My father worked in a kitchen. My mother sold knockoffs for the Chinese downtown. I went to Fordham. So if you fuck around with me, you donkey asshole, I'll send you to the federal supermax where you'll be drooling your oatmeal inside of 6 weeks. Comprende me, puñeto?
Turn the tape back on. Weintraub turns the tape back on.
This tape will be filed securely and only accessible to the people at this table, Paz says. There will be no transcript. Agent Odell will summarize these proceedings in a report, which will be accessible only to authorized Southern District, New York State, and FBI personnel.
That 302 could get me killed, Malone says. Odell says,
I guarantee it's security.
Right, because there are no crooked feds, Malone says.
No lawyer upside down in his house. No secretary whose husband is behind on the VIG.
Paz says, if you know names.
I don't know any names, Malone says. I only know 302s have a way of winding up in social clubs next to espresso cups, and that the reason there won't be a transcript is so the Bureau can put its own spin on what I've said.
Paz sets down a pen. Do you want to make a proffer or not?
Malone sighs.
Yes.
No proffer, no deal. She swears him in. Malone promises to tell the truth, the whole truth.
You've seen evidence of yourself accepting a payment for referring a defendant to legal counsel,
Paz says.
Do you acknowledge that?
Yes.
You also appear to be entering a conspiracy to bribe a prosecutor to fix a case on behalf of that defendant. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Is that called buying a case?
That's what I call it.
How many times?
Paz asks.
Have you bought a case or facilitated in such?
Malone shrugs. Paz looks at him with disgust.
So many you've lost count.
You're mixing two things, Malone explains. Sometimes I'd refer a suspect to a lawyer for a fee. Other times I would help approach a prosecutor to buy a case and get a kickback from the prosecutor for that, too.
Thank you for the clarification, Paz says. How many simple referral fees have you accepted from defense attorneys?
Over the years? Malone asks. Maybe hundreds.
And from prosecutors who've been paid off?
Probably 20 or 30, Malone says. Over the years. Do you deliver the payment to the prosecutor? Weintraub asks.
Sometimes.
How many times?
Paz asks.
20.
Are you asking me or telling me?
Paz says. I didn't keep records.
I'm sure you didn't,
Paz says.
So roughly 20. I want names. I want dates. I want everything you can remember.
So this is crossing the line, Malone thought. If I start naming names, there's no going back. I'm a rat. He starts with the oldest cases, giving them people he knows are retired or have moved on to other jobs. Most prosecutors don't stay in the job for too long, but use it as an apprenticeship to get to the more lucrative defense bar. This will still jam him up, but not as bad as a guy still in the job.
Mark Bocconi?
Odell asks.
I took money from Bocconi,
Malone says.
Because what the fuck, they all saw it. Is that the first time?
Paz asks. Did it look like the first time? Malone says.
I'd say I've referred Bocconi probably a dozen times.
How many times have you taken payoffs to prosecutors for him?
Three.
Were they all with Justin Michaels? Paz asks. Michaels is small potatoes, Malone thinks. Why all this for little routine shit? Michaels isn't a bad guy. He'll take money on lowball busts that aren't going anywhere anyway, but he's stand up on the assaults, the robberies, the rapes. Now they're gonna jam him up. No, Malone tells himself. Now you're gonna jam him up. But fuck it, they know anyway. He says. Two of them were with Michaels. Which cases? Weintraub asks. He's angry. One was a dope case. A quarter key of coke. Malone says. Guy named Mario Silvestri. That motherfucker. Weintraub snaps. It draws a wry smile from Paz. What was the other one? Weintraub asks. It was a dog shit gun charge on a smack slinger named, Malone says. I don't remember his real name. His street name was Long Dog. Clemens, maybe. DeAndre Clemens, Weintraub says. Yeah, that's it, Malone says. Michaels jacked up the chain of evidence. The judge threw it out in the evidentiary. You want the name of the judge? Later, Odell says. Yeah, later, Malone says. And I'll bet that somehow won't make it into the 302. So, Silvestri and Clemens, Pa says. And now Bailey? You weren't going to get convictions on those guys anyway, Malone says. So what difference does it make if someone other than drug dealers make a little money for a change? Are you really trying to justify this? Paz asks. I'm only saying that we find these skulls a few grand, Malone says, which is more than you could have done. So you distribute justice, Paz says. You're damn right I do, Malone thinks. More than the system does. I distributed on the street when I beat some creep who's molested a child. I delivered in the courts when I test a lie about some heroin dealer you'd never convict if I didn't. And yeah, I deliver it when I find these motherfuckers some money you'd never get out of them. He says, there's all kinds of justice. And I suppose you donate this money to charity? Some of it. Every now and then he takes an envelope of cash and mails it off to St. Jude's, but these motherfuckers don't need to know that. Malone doesn't want their dirty hands touching something clean. What else have you done? Paz asks. I need full disclosure. Jesus shit, Malone thinks. It's Pena. This has all been a setup for Pena. But do you think I'm going to volunteer it? Malone thinks. You think I'm some junkie skull in the interview room who's going to go for anything just to get well? If you ask questions, I'll answer them, Malone says. Have you ever robbed drug dealers? Paz asks. This is about Pena, Malone thinks. If they know anything, they'll press on it. So keep it short. Don't give them an opening. No. Have you ever taken drugs or money that you haven't vouchered? Paz asks. No. Have you ever sold drugs? No. You've never given drugs to an informant? Paz asks. Legally, that constitutes selling. I have to give us something. Malone thinks. Yes, I've done that. Is that a common practice? For me, yes, Malone says. That's one way I garner the information that gets me the arrests I bring to you. And have you ever seen an addict suffer? He thinks. Seen one Jones? Shake, cramp up, beg, cry? You'd fix them too. Is it common practice among other cops? Paz asks now. I'm speaking for myself. Malone says. Not other cops. But you must know. Next question. Have you ever beaten a suspect to obtain information or a confession? Paz asks. Are you fucking kidding me? I've welled the living shit out of him. Sometimes literally. I wouldn't say beaten. What would you say? Look, Malone says. Maybe I've slapped a guy. Shoved him into a wall. That's about it. That's all? Paz asks. What did I just say? You ask, but you don't want to know. You want to live on the Upper East Side or in the Village or up in Westchester, and you don't want the shit leaking into your nice neighborhoods. You don't want to know how that happens for you. You just want me to do it. What about other cops? Paz asks. What about your teammates? Are they in on selling cases? I'm not talking about my teammates. Come on, Weintraub says. You expect us to believe that Russo and Montague aren't in on this with you? I don't have any expectations about what you believe or don't. You make all that money by yourself? Weintraub says. You don't cut them in? What kind of partner are you? Malone doesn't answer. It's unbelievable on the face of it, Weintraub mutters. The proffer requires full disclosure, Pa says. I already made it clear, Malone says. I won't go after cops. Here's what you got now, chica. You got one defense attorney for capping. You got one cop for bragging he can buy a case. You got Piconi disbarred. You can take my shield and maybe put me inside for a couple years. But you and I both know your bosses are going to look at that and ask, is that all we get for our money? You'll look like an asshole. So let me tell you how it's going to go. He continues. It's as simple as ABC. Anyone but cops. I'll get you Michaels. I'll get you a few defense lawyers and a prosecutor or two. I'll even throw in a couple judges if you have the balls. In exchange for that, I walk. No jail time. I keep my shield and gun. Malone stands up, walks to the door, and puts his fingers to his mouth and ear like, call me. He's waiting for the elevator when Odell comes out. Must have been a quick meeting.
All right, Odell says. We have a deal.
Yeah, we do, Malone thinks, because everyone can be bought. It's just a matter of finding the right coin. Claudette's sick. Nose running, body shaking, bone aching, junkie sick. Malone has to give her credit, though. At least she's trying to kick again. But she quickly disabuses him of that notion.
I tried to score, but I couldn't find my guy. Did you do something to him?
I didn't hurt him, if that's what you mean, Malone says.
You get a doctor to give you something? Because if not, I got a guy.
Trauma doctor gave me some Robaxin,
she says. You're not afraid he'll dime you to admit?
After the shit I seen him do?
Is it helping?
Does it look like it's helping?
He's heating up water to make some herbal tea. The herbs will do exactly shit, but the tea might warm her up a little. Let me take you to detox.
No. I get worried, you know? Don't,
she says.
Alcoholics die in withdrawal, not heroin users. We just get sick and go out and use again.
That's what I'm worried about.
If I was going to, I would have,
she says. She finishes the tea. He wraps a blanket around her and then holds her. Rocks her like a baby. If it was another guy, he'd have told him to cut his woman loose. A junkie. What you do is you hold a funeral like she's dead. You grieve, and then you move on, because the person you knew ain't there anymore. But he can't seem to do that with Claudette. Chapter 13. Next morning, Malone goes into Rand's down the street from the courthouse with a copy of the New York Post under his arm. A few minutes later, Piconi slides into the booth across from him and sets the Daily News on the table.
Page 6 is good today. How good? $20,000 good.
It costs more to buy some cases than others. Simple possession, a couple grand. Possession with intent to sell, you're looking double digits. A heavyweight with intention could go 6 figures easy, but then again, if the defendant has that kind of weight, he has that kind of money. Weapons charges these days, it gets up there. Especially if the defendant has a yellow sheet. Fat Teddy could be going for 5 to 7 years, so this is a bargain. Malone has to pin Piconi down, they told him. Pretend the conversation is being played for a jury. If I get Michaels to sell a case for 20, you good with that? Malone takes the Daily News, sets it down beside him.
Only if you get him to drop, decline to prosecute.
For 20K, I can get him to say it was his gun.
What are you having?
Piconi asks.
The pancakes are sort of edible.
No, I gotta move. He gets up with the Daily News, leaves the Post for Piconi. He goes into the men's room and cuts 5K from the envelope inside the paper, puts that in his pocket, and goes on the street. Malone's always thought that 100 Center Street is one of the most depressing places on earth. Nothing good ever happens in the criminal courts building. Even when the rare good, like a bad guy getting convicted, sneaks through the bad, it's always behind a tragedy. There's always a victim, at least one grieving family or a bunch of kids whose daddy or mommy is going away. Malone finds Michaels in the hallway, hands him the paper.
You should read this. Yeah, why?
Fat Teddy Bailey.
Bailey, he's fucked.
15K get your dick out of his ass?
Did you take a finder's fee?
Michaels asks. You want this money or you don't? Malone asks. But it's for a pass, not a plea. Michaels puts the paper in his canvas bag. Then he starts the show.
God damn it, Malone, this gets tossed on a Dunaway.
Probable cause. A couple people glance over as they pass by. Malone glances over to make sure they're watching, and then for their benefit, he yells,
Known felon! And I saw a gun bulge. What kind of coat was Bailey wearing? The hell am I, Ralph Lauren?
Malone says, playing it out.
A down coat,
Michael says.
A North Face down coat. You're gonna stand there and tell me, no, you're gonna tell a judge you could see a 25 under that? I'm supposed to go in there and look like an asshole? A racist asshole to boot?
You're supposed to go in there and do your job.
You do yours,
Michaels yells.
Make a goddamn bust I can work with.
You're gonna put this mook back on the street?
No, you're gonna put him back on the street,
Michael says, walking away.
Pussy,
Malone says. Jesus Christ. People look at him standing in a hallway, but it's not unusual. Cops and ADAs get into it all the time. Malone goes up to the third floor of the old textile building in the garment district, where Odell has set up his operation. A couple of desks and the hello phone. Red boxes of files, cheap metal cabinets, a coffee maker. Malone hands him the $5,000, shucks his jacket, rips off the wire, and sets it on the desk.
Did you get it?
Odell asks. Yeah, I got it. Weintraub grabs the tape, fast-forwards it to the conversation with Michaels, listens, and then says, God fucking damn it. This gonna do it? Malone asks. I put them both in the ship for you?
What? You feel bad?
Weintraub says. You wanna take their place?
Shut up, Stan,
says Odell.
You did a good job, Denny.
Yeah, I'm a good rat, Malone says, heading for the door and out of that sickening fucking place, literally a rat hole. And what's this fucking Denny, he thinks. We friends now or something? It's all Stan and Denny, like we're on the same team now? And pat me on the head. You did a good job, Denny. I'm your fucking dog now?
Where are you going?
Odell asks.
The fuck is it to you?
Malone asks. Or what? I'm not free to leave? You afraid I'm gonna go warn the guy? Don't worry, I'd be too ashamed.
You have nothing to be ashamed of, Odell says. You're gonna be ashamed? You should be ashamed of what you were doing, not what you're doing now.
I didn't come here looking for your fucking absolution.
No?
Odell asks.
I kinda think you did.
I think some part of you wanted to get caught, Denny. Is that what you think? Malone asks. Then you're an even bigger asshole than I thought you were.
You want to get a coffee? A drink?
Odell asks. Malone whirls on him. Don't handle me, Odell. You know how many informers I've handled, coddled, seduced, told them they were doing the right thing? I give them heroin, not coffee. And I know the cardinal rule of dealing with them. You can't think of them as people. They're snitches. You start falling in love with them, caring about them, thinking of them as anything but what they are, they'll end up killing you. I'm your snitch, Odell. Don't fuck up by trying to treat me like a person. Claudette says pretty much the same thing to him when he goes to check in on her. He walks in the door, and the first words out of her mouth are you ashamed to be seen with me?
The fuck did that come from?
He asks. He looks to see if her eyes are pinned, but they aren't. She hasn't been using. She's been hanging in there, jonesing, and he knows it's tough as hell, and she's angry, and now she's gonna take it out on him. I've been thinking about why I relapsed. You relapse because you're an addict, he thinks. Why haven't I ever met your partners? She asks. You've met their mistresses, haven't you? You're not my mistress. What am I? Oh, fuck. My girlfriend. You haven't introduced me because I'm black, she says.
Claudette, one of my partners is black.
And you don't want him to know you're doing a sister? She says. Yeah, that's partially true. Malone thinks. He didn't know how Monty would react, whether he'd be okay with it or if he'd be pissed. Why do you want to meet them? Why don't you want me to meet them? She asks back. Is it because I'm black or because I'm an addict? Nobody knew about that, Malone says. Because nobody knew about me.
Well, they do now, Malone says.
Why are my partners so important to you? They're your family, she says. They know your wife, your children, you know theirs. They know everyone important in your life, except me, which makes me think I'm not. I don't know what more I can do to... I'm your shadow life, she says. You hide me. That's bullshit. We almost never go out, she says.
That's true,
Between her schedule and his, it's a tough get, and anyway, it's awkward, even in 2017. A white man with a black woman in Harlem, when they do go out together, to a coffee shop or to the grocery store, they get looks, sideways glances, and sometimes outright stares. And he's not just a white man, he's a white cop. That causes hostility, or something worse. Maybe some of the locals figuring Malone will cut them a break because he's with a black woman. I'm not ashamed of you, Malone said. It's just that... He goes on to explain his concern that the people in the neighborhood might think he'd slacken up. But you want to go out? We'll go out. Let's go out right now.
Look at me. I'm a mess, she says. I don't want to go out.
Jesus Christ, you just said...
I mean, what is this? Some kind of brown sugar thing?
She asks.
Jungle fever? You just come over here and fuck me?
No. You fuck me back, baby, he thought, but was just smart enough not to say.
Denny, did you ever think you might be one of the reasons I use?
Jesus fucking Christ, Claudette. You ever think you're one of the reasons I just turned fucking snitch? That I just turned fucking rat? That your fucking addiction, your fucking disease is what made me do that?
Fuck you, he says. Fuck you right back.
He gets up.
Where are you going?
She asks.
Somewhere that's not here.
You mean somewhere away from me?
Yeah, okay. Go,
Claudette says.
Go away. You want to be with me? You treat me like a person, not some junky whore.
He slams the door on his way out. Chapter 14. Malone and Russo take in a Rangers game. Tickets on the blue line, comped by a guy from the Garden who still likes cops, which is like fewer and fewer people, Malone thinks. Just last month, two plainclothes in an unmarked vehicle out near Ozone Park in Queens saw a guy standing next to a double-parked car with an open bottle of booze. A bullshit C-summons, but when they went to front the guy, he ran. You run on cops, they're gonna chase. It's the golden retriever mentality. They cornered him, he pulled a gun. The cops shot him 13 times. A family hired a lawyer who started litigating the case in the media. A father of five young children was hit with 13 bullets, including shots to the back and head, all because of an open container. First you had Garner killed over selling Luckies, then Michael Bennett. Now you have a guy killed over a freaking open container.
Gotta hand it to the commissioner, though. He stood up.
The best way to not get shot by a New York City police officer is not carry a gun and not raise that gun toward them.
Syntax and grammar aside, as Monty observed, it was a strong statement, especially when the commissioner added,
My cops go out there every day and put their lives at risk, and the attorneys, the games they play,
the lawyer fired back.
We certainly have empathy for good cops who risk their lives to protect our communities. Who doesn't? But as for games being played, one needs to simply open up a newspaper any day of the week to learn of the lying, cheating, and stealing committed by members of the NYPD, so you'll excuse me if I don't immediately take their word for what occurred.
So the job's taking it from all sides. The protesters are out, the activists are calling for action, and the tension between the police and the community is worse than ever. And still no call from the Bennett grand jury. So when black guys aren't shooting black people, the cops are shooting black people. Either way, Malone thinks, black people die. And he goes on being a cop. New York goes on being New York. The world goes on being the world. Yeah, it does and it doesn't. His world has changed. He's a rat. The first time you do it, Malone thinks, it's life-changing. The second time, it's just life. The third time, Malone thinks, it's your life. It's who you are. The first time he wore a wire, he felt like everyone in the world could see it, like it was glued to his forehead. It felt like a thick scar on his skin, a cut that's still stitched and pulled. This last time, it slipped on easier than his belt. He hardly noticed it was there. Odell doesn't call him a rat. The FBI agent calls him a rock star. Rock star. By mid-May, Malone had given the feds four defense lawyers and three ADAs. Paz's office is busy typing up sealed indictments. They're not going to make arrests until they're ready to spring the entire trap. The fucked up thing is that when he's not trapping dirty lawyers, Malone just goes on being a cop. Like none of this is really happening. He goes to the job. He works with his team. He monitors the surveillance on Carter. He deals with Sykes. He rides the streets, works his snitches, makes the busts that are there to be made. He goes to the shooting scenes. 2 weeks after the Gillette Williams killings, a Trinitario up in Inwood was walking home from a club and took a round in the back of the head. 10 days later, a spade in North St. Nick's got laced with a shotgun blast from a drive-by. He's in Harlem Hospital, but he ain't gonna make it. And as Malone predicted, the goodwill from the Williams arrest lasted about an hour and a half. Now Sykes is cashing in at the Comstat meeting. The commissioner's cashing it from the mayor from the media. Sykes is all up Malone's ass for progress on the guns. He's up everyone's ass. Got Malone working Carter, Torres on Castillo, has the plainclothes out trying to get guns off the street, the undercover's trying to buy them. Yeah, shit flows downhill. It's Levin that gets him the break. Fucking Levin. He showed up one day with his iPad and sat in the liquor store closet banging away. Russo and Monty, they figured the kid was just screwing around online, watching Netflix. They didn't care. It's a monotonous gig and you gotta do something. But one day, he came out looking prouder than a 14-year-old who just got his first tit, and he opened up the iPad and said, "Look at this." "The fuck you do?" "I hacked his phones," Levin said. "I mean, not the voice. We can't hear the other half of the conversations, but every time he makes or receives a call, it comes on the screen."
"Levin," Monty said, "you may have actually justified your existence on this earth."
No shit. Now they know who Fat Teddy's talking to, and he's talking to Mantell a lot.
"Volume analysis,"
Levin said. As they get closer to a delivery, the traffic will pick up.
"But how do we know where they're going to exchange?" Malone asked.
"We don't yet," Levin said.
"But we will." "Carter won't go near the exchange," Monty said. "He's not even on the phone now. Has Fat Teddy handling everything?"
"We don't care about Carter," Malone said. "Just the guns. Maybe stop a bloodbath." So Malone's trying to be a real cop, do real police work, restore the peace in his kingdom. Peace of mind? That he can't restore. The shooting war going on inside his own head. Monty wasn't interested in coming to the Rangers game.
"Black folk don't go near ice."
"They are black hockey players," Malone said.
"Race traitors."
"They'd have taken Levin, but you can't get him off the Fat Teddy surveillance with a crowbar and a hand grenade, so it's just Malone and Phil there to watch the Penguins wipe the Rangers out of the playoffs. They're sitting with beers, and Russo says, "The fuck's going on with you?"
"What do you mean?"
"When's the last time you saw your kids?"
"Who are you, my priest right now?"
Malone asks. "You want to fuck me in the ass, father?"
"Drink your beer."
"Sorry I asked."
"I'll come out this weekend. Do what you want," Russo says.
Then he asks,
"What about the black woman? You deal with that?"
"Jesus fucking Christ, Phil."
"Okay, okay.
Can we watch the fucking game?" They watch the fucking game, as the Rangers do what the Rangers do, blow a lead in the third period, and then get beat in OT. Malone and Russo go to the bar at Jack Doyle's after the game for a nightcap. The TV news is on, and Reverend Cornelius is talking about the Ozone Park police killing. Fucking lawyer-looking fuck in a suit standing at the bar, his tie loosened around his neck, starts shooting his mouth off.
"Cops executed that guy."
Russo sees the look in Malone's eyes. Seen that look before, and now Malone's had a few beers and three Jamesons back to back to back.
"Take it easy. Fuck him.
Let it slide, Denny." But the loudmouth won't let it go. Starts lecturing the whole bar about the militarization of our police forces. And the funny thing is, Malone don't even disagree with him. It's just, he's not in the mood for this shit. He's staring at the guy. The guy sees it and looks back at him, and Malone says,
"What are you looking at?"
The guy wants to back down.
"Nothing."
Malone slides off the stool. "No, what the fuck are you looking at, mouth?" Russo gets behind him, puts his hand on his shoulder. "Come on, Danny, chill." Malone shoves his hand off. "You fucking chill." The guy's buddies, they're trying to move him out of the bar, and Russo is all in agreement with that. He says,
"Why don't you take your friend home? What are you, a lawyer?"
Malone asks the guy.
"Yeah, as a matter of fact."
"Well, I'm a cop," Malone says. "I'm a New York City fucking police detective."
"Enough, Denny."
"I'll have your badge," the guy says.
"What's your name?"
"Denny Malone. Sergeant Dennis John Malone, Manhattan motherfucking North."
Russo lays a couple 20s on the bar, says to the bartender,
"It's okay, we're getting out of here. After I kick this pussy's ass," Malone says.
Russo gets between them, shoves Malone back, and hands the guy his card.
"Look, he's had a tough week, a few too many.
Take this. You need a favor sometime, a ticket fixed, whatever. You call. Your buddy's an asshole.
Tonight I can't argue, Russo says. He grabs Malone and hauls him out of the bar and shoves him onto 8th Avenue.
Danny, what the fuck?
Guy pissed me off.
You want to get IAB up our ass?
Russo asks.
Give Sykes more of a hard-on for you than he already has? Jesus.
Let's go get a drink.
Let's put you to bed.
I'm a New York City police detective.
Yeah, I heard that,
Russo says.
Everybody did.
New York's finest.
Okay, champ.
They walk to the parking lot and Russo drives him home. Takes him upstairs.
Danny, do yourself a favor. Stay here. Don't go out anymore tonight.
I won't. I got caught tomorrow.
Yeah, you're gonna look great,
Russo says.
You gonna set an alarm or should I call you?
Alarm.
I'll call you. Get some sleep.
Drunk dreams are the worst dreams. Maybe because your brain is already fucked over and ready to give up to the sickest shit you got running around in there. Tonight, he dreams about the Cleveland family. Two adults, three kids, dead in their apartment. Executed. The kids ask him for help, but he can't help them. He can't help them. He just stands there and cries and cries and cries. Malone gets up in the morning and downs 5 glasses of water. Head hurts like a motherfucker. Whiskey with a beer chaser is good. Beer with a whiskey chaser is a catastrophe. He pops 3 aspirin, 2 Dexies, showers and shaves, and then gets dressed. His court costume today is a white shirt with a red tie, blue blazer, gray slacks, and polished black shoes. You don't wear a suit to court unless you're at least a lieutenant or above, because you don't want to show up to lawyers and you want the jury to see you as an honest working stiff. No cufflinks today. No Armani, no boss. Straight up, Joseph A. Banks. Mary Hinman sees him and laughs.
That your schoolboy costume?
Red hair, freckled pale skin. The special prosecutor for narcotics could be out of the cast of Riverdance if she were taller. But Hinman is small, a description she rejects.
I'm not small, she says when the topic comes up. I'm concentrated.
Which is no shit true, Malone thinks now, sitting across the table from her. Hinman is ferocious, a 4'5" little ball of rage who came up the traditional way. Catholic all-girls school, Fordham University, then NYU Law. Hinman's feet can't touch the floor from the bar stool, but she can drink you under the table. Malone knows. He went shot for shot with her the night she got a verdict against a dealer named Corey Gaines for killing his girlfriend. Malone lost. Hinman put him in a cab. She comes by it honest. Her father was an alcoholic cop. Her mother, an alcoholic cop's wife. Hinman knows cops. She knows how it works. Nevertheless, when she was a rookie ADA, Malone had to teach her a few things her father hadn't. It was her first major drug case, long before she'd elbowed past her male counterparts to become special prosecutor, and Malone was in plain clothes and anti-crime. But it was a whole kilo of coke Malone and his then-partner, Billy Foster, made in a tenement on 148th. They got a tip from a snitch, but not enough to get a warrant. Malone wasn't about to hand it over to narcotics. He wanted the collar, so he and Foster went in on a gunshot warrant, arrested the dealer, and then called it in. It got him a chewing out from his sergeant in narcotics, but it also got him attention. Normally, he wouldn't care if it also got a conviction, but he wanted this scalp on his belt and was worried that a rookie ADA, a woman to boot, would jack up his case. When she called him in for witness preparation, Hinman said,
"Just tell the truth and get the conviction."
"Which?" Malone asked.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean," Malone said, "I can tell the truth or I can get the conviction. Which do you want?"
"Both,"
Hinman said. "You can't have both." Because if he told the truth, they'd lose the case on a map issue because Malone had no warrant and no probable cause to enter the apartment. The evidence would become the fruit of a poisoned tree, and the dealer would walk. She thought this over for a few seconds and then said,
"I can't suborn or encourage perjury, Officer Malone. I can only advise you to do what you think you need to do."
Mary Hinman never advised Malone to just tell the truth again. Because the real truth that they both know is that without cops test the lion, the DA's office would hardly get any convictions at all. This doesn't bother Malone. If the world played fair, he'd play fair. But the cards are stacked against the prosecutors and police. Miranda, Mapp, All the other Supreme Court decisions give the advantage to the Skels. It's like the NFL these days. The league wants touchdown passes, so a defensive back can't even touch a receiver. We're the poor defensive backs, Malone thinks, trying to keep the bad guys from scoring. Truth, justice, and the American way. The American way is, Truth and Justice maybe say hello in the hallway, send each other a Christmas card, but that's about the extent of their relationship. Hinman gets it. Now she sits across the table in a courthouse meeting room and looks at Malone.
The hell did you do last night?
Rangers game.
Uh-huh,
she says.
You ready to testify? Give me a preview.
My partner, Detective Sergeant Philip Russo, Malone says, and I received information from neighborhood residents that there was suspicious activity at 324 West 132nd Street. We'd set up a visual surveillance of the address and observed a white Escalade pull up and the defendant, Mr. Rivera, get out. I didn't have a conclusive reason to believe that it contained drugs, certainly not sufficient visual evidence to indicate probable cause. This was a cool part of their dance. Take it the other way, to convince the jury that you're telling the truth. Plus, they expect it from watching television. Hinman asks,
if you didn't have probable cause, what gave you the right to force entry into the apartment?
Mr. Rivera was not alone, Malone says. Two other men exited the vehicle with him. One was carrying a MAC-10 machine pistol with a suppressor, Malone says. The other was carrying a Tech-9.
And you saw these?
Malone says the magic words. They were in plain sight. If a weapon is in plain sight, you don't need probable cause. You have immediate cause. And the weapons were in plain sight. At Malone's feet.
So you gained entry to the address, Hinman says. Did you identify yourselves as police officers?
We did. I yelled, New York City Police, and our badges were clearly visible on lanyards over our protective vests.
What happened next?
Hinman asks. We planted the machine guns on those dumb mooks. The suspects dropped their weapons.
What did you find in the apartment?
Malone says. 4 kilos of heroin and an amount of American currency and $100 bills that eventually turned out to be $550,000. She goes over the boring shit about the voucher numbers and how he could be certain that the heroin he seized was the same heroin now in the courtroom, blah, blah, blah. And then she said,
I hope you bring a little more energy at trial than you did in this session.
In the words of Allen Iverson, Malone says, we're talking about practice here. Practice. Hinman says,
we're talking about Gerard Berger.
This is how Malone sums up his opinion of Gerard Berger.
If he was on fire, Malone has said, I'd piss gasoline on him to put it out.
Denny Malone hates three things in life, not necessarily in the following order. 1, child molesters. 2, rats, the human variety. 3, Gerard Berger. The defense attorney doesn't pronounce his name like what you get at P.J. Clark's. He pronounces it Berger and insists that you do too, which Malone steadfastly refuses to do, except in open court so he doesn't look like a smartass in front of the judge. Anywhere else, it's Jerry Berger. Malone isn't alone in his hatred of Berger. Every prosecutor, cop, correctional officer, and victim despises him. Even his own clients hate him, because by the time the case is concluded, Berger owns much of what they used to. Their money, their houses, their cars, their boats, sometimes their women. But, as he reminds them,
you can't spend money in prison.
Berger's clients usually don't go to prison. They go home, or they go on probation, or they go into drug rehab or anger management classes. They go back to doing what they were doing, which is usually something criminal. He doesn't care. Drug traffickers, murderers, wife beaters, rapists, child molesters. Berger will take any client who has a fat wallet or a story that can be sold to a publisher or the movies or preferably both, such as Diego Peña. He's seen versions of himself portrayed by A-list actors, some of whom have come to him for advice, which he sums up in the simple phrase,
be a total asshole.
It has been said that the only time any of Berger's clients confess is on Oprah, and then he has the confession tossed out. Berger doesn't bother to hide his wealth. He flaunts it. Multi-$1,000 custom suits, custom shirts, designer ties, designer shoes, expensive watches. He comes to court in Ferraris or Maseratis, cars that were given to him, Malone figures, in lieu of payment. He has the penthouse on the Upper East Side, the summer place in the Hamptons, the ski condo in Aspen that was signed over to him by a grateful client who now resides in Colombia and whose deal doesn't allow him to come back to the United States anyway.
Malone has to admit that Berger is very good at what he does. He's a great paper lawyer, a genius at motions, especially to exclude, a canny and vicious cross-examiner, and a master of opening statements and closing arguments. The biggest secret to a success is that he's dirty. Of this, Malone is convinced. He's never been able to prove it, but Malone would bet his left testicle that Berger has judges on the arm. The other filthy secret of the so-called justice system. Most people don't realize it, but judges don't make a lot of money, and they usually have to spend a lot to get the robe. The mathematics of that means that a lot of them can be bought. It doesn't take a lot to swing a case. A motion granted or denied, evidence excluded or admitted, testimony allowed or stricken. Little things, small things, arcane details that can spring a guilty defendant. The defense bar knows, shit, everyone knows, which cases they can buy. One of the most lucrative judicial posts is on the scheduling docket. For the right money, you can pay to have a case assigned to the judge you've already purchased. Or rented, anyway. Malone and Hinman do their dance on direct examination, and then they adjourn for a few minutes before Berger starts his cross. Malone goes to take a shit. When he comes out of the stall to wash his hands, Berger is at the next sink. They look at each other in the mirror.
Detective Sergeant Malone,
Berger says.
What a pleasure.
Hey, Jerry Berger, how's it hanging?
Oh, it's hanging just fine, Berger says. I can't wait to get you on the stand. I'm going to eviscerate you, humiliate you, and show you to be the lying, corrupt police officer that you are.
You buy the judge, Jerry?
The corrupt see only corruption,
Berger says. He dries his hands.
See you on the stand, Sergeant.
Hey, Jerry, Malone calls after him.
Your office still smell like dog shit?
Malone and Berger, they go way back. He takes a stand, and the bailiff reminds him that he's still sworn in. Berger smiles at him and says,
Sergeant Malone, does the phrase testifying mean anything to you?
Generally.
Well, generally, what does it mean around police circles?
Objection, Hinman says. Relevance?
He may answer.
I've heard it in reference to police not telling the exact truth on the stand, Malone says.
The exact truth,
Berger says.
Is there an inexact truth?
Same objection?
Where is this going, counselor?
The judge asks.
I'll develop, Your Honor. All right, but do so.
There are different points of view, Malone says. Ah. Berger looks to the jury.
And isn't it true that officers' point of view is that they testify in order to convict a defendant that they feel is guilty, regardless of the admissible evidence?
I've heard it used in that context.
But you've never done it?
No, I have not, Malone says, if you don't count a few hundred exceptions.
Not even on your last answer?
Berger asks.
Argumentative? Sustained,
the judge says.
Move on, counselor. Now,
Berger says,
it's your testimony that you did not have probable cause to enter the apartment on suspicion of drugs. Is that correct?
Yes.
And it's your sworn testimony that you did have probable cause based on seeing my client's associates carrying weapons. Is that correct?
Yes. You saw the weapons. They were in plain sight, Malone says.
Is that a yes?
Yes.
And absent your seeing those weapons in plain sight,
Berger says,
you had no probable cause to enter that domicile. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And when you saw those weapons,
Berger says,
they were in the suspect's possession. Is that correct?
Yes.
I'd like to enter in evidence this document,
Berger says.
What is it?
Hinman asks.
We haven't been notified of this. It just came into our possession, Your Honor.
Both counsel approach the bench.
Malone watches Hinman go up. She flashes him a WTF look, but he doesn't know what the fuck either.
Your Honor, Berger says, this is an evidence voucher dated 5/22/2013. You'll note it logs in a MAC-10 pistol with the serial number B-7842A14.
Yes.
It was vouchered into the evidence room of the 32nd precinct on the date recorded. The 32nd is, of course, in Manhattan North.
What's the relevance of this?
If the court admits, Berger says, I will demonstrate relevance.
Admitted.
I object, Hinman says. We were not given access to this document.
Your objection is preserved for appeal, Ms. Hinman.
Berger goes back to the cross-examination. He hands Malone a document.
Do you recognize this?
Yes. It's an evidence voucher for the MAC-10 pistol removed from one of the suspects.
Is that your signature?
Yes.
Will you read for us the serial number of that weapon?
Berger asks.
B-784-2A-14?
Berger hands him another document.
Do you recognize this?
It appears to be another evidence voucher.
Well, it doesn't appear to be, Berger says. That's what it is, isn't it?
Yes.
And it vouchers in a MAC-10 pistol. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Please read us the date of that voucher.
May 22nd, 2013.
God damn it, Malone thinks. God damn it, they assured me the weapons were squeaky clean. Berger is walking him toward a cliff, and there's no stopping.
Now, please read us the serial number, Berger says,
of the MAC-10 pistol seized on May 22nd, 2013. I'm totally fucked, Malone thinks.
B-7842A14.
Malone hears the jury react. He doesn't look over, but he knows they're staring daggers at him now.
It's the same weapon, isn't it?
Berger asks. How the fuck did he get this voucher? Malone wonders. Like everything else, dummy. He bought it.
It seems to be.
So, Berger says, as an experienced police officer, could you tell us how the same weapon could be locked away in the 32nd Precinct evidence room and then magically appear in plain sight in the suspect's hands on the night of February 13, 2015? Argumentative, calls for speculation.
I'm gonna allow it.
The judge is pissed.
I don't know, Malone says.
Well, there are only so many possibilities,
Berger says.
Is it possible it was stolen from the evidence locker and sold to alleged drug traffickers? Is that a possibility?
I suppose that's possible.
Or is it more possible,
Berger says,
that you took this weapon in order to plant it on the suspects and cook up a pretext for probable cause?
No.
Not even possible, Sergeant,
Berger asks, enjoying himself immensely.
Not even possible that you burst into that domicile, shot two suspects, killed one of them, planted weapons on them, and then lied about it.
Hinman jumped up.
Argumentative, speculative, calls for hypothetical. Your Honor, defense counsel is...
Approach the bench.
Your Honor, Hinman says, we do not know the provenance of this document. We were not allowed sufficient time to investigate its legitimacy, its accuracy.
God damn it, Mary,
the judge says.
If you cooked up this case,
I wouldn't for one moment impugn Ms. Hinman's ethics, Berger says. But the fact remains that if Sergeant Malone did not see the weapons as he claims that he did, there was no probable cause, and any evidence found in the domicile is fruit of a poisoned tree. I'll move to dismiss, Your Honor.
Not so fast, Hinman says. Defense counsel himself brought up the possibility that the weapon was stolen from the locker, and...
You bring me one big headache here,
the judge says. He sighs, then adds,
I'm going to exclude the MAC-10.
That still leaves the Tech-9.
Right, Berger says. The jury is going to believe that one weapon is dirty, but the other is clean, please.
Malone knows that Hinman is considering her options, all of them shitty. One of them is that NYPD officers are selling automatic weapons out of their evidence rooms to drug dealers. Another is that a highly decorated NYPD detective perjured himself on the stand.
If she goes with that, it could open up a flood of headlines. The shooting becomes wrong, and IAB launches an investigation on one Sergeant Denny Malone, including all his previous testimony. Hinman could lose not only this case, but have 20 others reversed. 20 guilty Skells will walk out of prison, and she'll walk the plank. There's one other option. He hears Hinman ask Berger, "Would your client be open to a plea offer?"
"It depends on the offer."
Malone feels the bile rise in his mouth as Hinman says, "One count is simple possession, a $25,000 fine, 2 years with time served deducted, and deportation."
"$20,000, time served, and deportation."
"Your Honor?" Hinman asks. The judge is disgusted.
"If the defendant agrees, I will accept that plea and issue the negotiated sentence."
"One more thing," Hinman says. "The record is sealed."
"I have no problem with that,"
Berger says with a smirk. There was no media in the room, Hinman thinks. There's a good chance of keeping this off the radar.
"The record is sealed," the judge says. "Mary, the court is not happy about this. Go do the paperwork. Send Malone into my chambers."
The judge gets up. Hinman walks over and tells Malone, "I'm going to fucking kill you." Berger just smiles at him. Malone goes into chambers. The judge doesn't offer him a seat.
"Sergeant Malone," the judge says, "you were about 3 syllables away from losing your shield, your gun, and being indicted for perjury."
"I stand by my testimony, Your Honor."
"As will Russo and Montague,"
the judge says. "The blue wall."
Goddamn right, Malone thinks. But he keeps his mouth shut.
"Thanks to you,"
the judge says,
"I have to release an almost certainly guilty defendant
to protect the NYPD, who are supposed to be protecting us."
"It's thanks to Berger, asshole," Malone thinks, "and some careless assholes at the 3-2 too lazy to shit can an old evidence voucher. Or who are on Berger's pad. Either way, I'll find out."
"Do you have anything to say, Sergeant?"
"The system is screwed up, Your Honor."
"Get out, Sergeant Malone. You make me sick."
"I make you sick?" Malone thinks as he walks out. "You make me sick, you hypocrite. You just participated in a cover-up of this thing. You know what's going on. You didn't protect cops out of the goodness of your heart. You protected us because you have to. You're part of the system, too."
Hinman is waiting for him in the hallway.
"Both our careers were swirling around the bowl in there," she says. "I had to cut that bastard a deal to save us."
"Poor you," Malone thinks. "I cut deals every damn day. A lot worse than this one."
"You know the score, so cut the Joan of Arc routine."
"I never told you to commit perjury."
"You don't care what we do when you get convictions," Malone says. "Do what you have to do. But let something go south, then you say, play by the rules. I'll play by the rules when everyone else does." After all, he thinks as he walks out, they don't call it the criminal courts for nothing.
Chapter 15. Malone meets his team up at Montefiore Square, which isn't a square, but a triangle formed by Broadway, Hamilton Place, and 138th.
"What we got?" Malone asks.
"Fat Teddy's made 37 calls to Georgia area codes in the past 3 days,
Levin says.
"The shipment's definitely coming."
"Yeah, but coming where?"
Malone asks. "Teddy won't give him an address until the last minute,"
Levin says.
"If he does it from the office, we might pick it up, but if he does it from the street, we'll know when he makes the call, but not what he says."
"Can we get a warrant on Teddy's phones?"
Monty asks.
"Based off what he heard of an illegal tap?"
Malone says. "Not these days."
Levin grins.
"What's funny?"
Russo asks.
"What if we take Teddy?"
Levin asks.
"He's not gonna tell us shit,"
Russo says.
"I don't care how many ding-dongs we have."
"No,"
Levin says.
"I have a better idea."
He lays it out.
The three older cops look at one another.
Then Russo says, "See, this is the difference between City College and NYU.
Sit on it," Malone tells Levin. "Let us know when it's on."
Malone sits down with Sykes in the captain's office.
"I need buy money," Malone says.
"For what?"
"Carter's gun's coming up on the pipeline," Malone says. "Mantell's not going to sell them to Carter. He's going to sell them to us."
Sykes gives him a long look.
"Map issues?"
There won't be any. We're going to do it on the street.
Behind what?
The CI's going to give us a meet, Malone says. We'll take the CI's place.
Did you file this CR?
Right after I leave your office.
How much?
$50,000, Malone says. Sykes laughs.
You want me to go to McGivern for $50,000 based on something you heard that you shouldn't have?
I'll have a typed and sworn CI statement.
As soon as you leave my office.
McGivern will get it for you, Malone says. It's a risk, but he has to take it.
If you tell him it's me.
That's a turd for Sykes to swallow.
When is this going down?
Sykes asks. Malone shrugs.
Soon. I'll talk to the inspector, Sykes says. But this travels down the straight and narrow. You communicate, you keep me in touch every step of the way.
You got it.
And I want you to bring in another team when it goes down, Sykes says. Use Torres and his people.
Captain Sykes.
What?
Not Torres.
What's wrong with Torres?
I need you to trust me on this one, Malone says. Sykes looks at him for several long seconds.
What are you trying to tell me, Sergeant?
Let my team handle the buy, Malone says. Bring the plain clothes and the uniforms in on the cellar. You distribute the collars any way you want. The whole task force dines out.
Only not Torres.
Only not Torres. More silence.
More of a look.
Then Sykes says,
if you fuck me on this, Malone, I will set a fire up your ass that will never go out.
I love it when you talk dirty to me, boss.
Did you perjure yourself in the Rivera case?
Paz asks him. Who'd you have lunch with? Malone asks. Jerry Berger? She tosses a file on the table.
Answer my question.
This file was sealed, Malone says. How did Berger get it to give it to you? She doesn't answer.
You think that piece of shit wins all his cases because he's so smart?
Malone asks. Because all his clients are innocent?
You don't think he ever bought a ruling, got some evidence tossed with an envelope?
He didn't need that to get your evidence tossed, did he? Paz asks.
You manufactured probable cause and then committed perjury.
If you say so.
The record says so,
Paz says.
Does Mary Hinman normally countenance this kind of thing to make her cases?
You're going after her now?
If she's dirty.
She's not, Malone says. Leave her alone.
Why? You fucking her?
Jesus Christ. If you perjured yourself, Paz says, our deal is invalid.
Do it, Malone says. He holds his hands out to be cuffed. No, come on, right now. Do it.
She keeps glaring at him.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
He lowers his hands.
You know why you won't?
Brady versus Maryland. You have to notify defense attorneys if a cop involved in their cases ever knowingly lied under oath. Because if I told you I had, it would open up 40 or 50 old cases of guys who are locked up and are going to want new trials. And it will open up questions of whether your buddy prosecutors knew I was lying and tolerated it to get those convictions. So don't give me your sanctimonious, condescending bullshit, because I'll bet to get the way you are, you did the same goddamn thing.
Silence in the room.
You fucking feds, Malone says. You'd lie, cheat, sell your mother's eyes to get a conviction. It's only wrong when a cop does it.
Shut up, Denny,
Odell says.
I've got you what, 6 indictments now? 7?
Malone asks.
When is this over? When is it enough?
It's over when we tell you it's over, Paz says.
When is that?
Malone asks.
How high up you want to go?
You got balls, Paz. You got big enough balls to go after judges? How much you think they clear after taxes? Enough for the condo down in West Palm?
How about when they go to Vegas, get comped, lose a bundle, and it gets written off too? You interested in how that happens?
What are you?
Weintraub asks.
A crusader all of a sudden?
Paz says. If you know something, everybody knows it. Malone says. The fucking Hindu at the newspaper stand knows it. A 10-year-old black kid on the corner knows it. What I'm asking is, how come you don't know it?
Silence.
Yeah,
It gets real quiet now, Malone says.
We have to work from the bottom up,
Odell says. Well, that's convenient, isn't it? Malone says. That works out nice for you. You never have to lay your asses on the line. I'm not going to sit here and be lectured by a crooked cop, Pa says. You know what? You don't have to, Malone says. He gets up.
Sit down, Danny, Odell says.
You got your money's worth from me, Malone says. I gave you all the lawyers I worked with. I'm done. Then we charge you, Pa says. Yeah, put me on the stand, Malone says. See what names I name. See what happens to your careers then. Any professional aspirations I may harbor, Pa says, have nothing to do with this. And I'm the Easter Bunny. He walks toward the door. You know, you're right, Malone, Pa says. You've taken us as far as you can with lawyers. Now I want cops. You dumb Mick motherfucker, Malone thinks. The lawyers were just to come along to get you in. How many times have you used the same game on snitches? Once you get their cherry, they're yours. You put them on the street and use them up. But you thought you were different, dumb shit. I told you from the jump, Malone says. No cops. You're gonna give me cops. Or when we unseal these indictments against the lawyers, I'll put it out that it was you. Paz lets that sit and then smiles at him. Run, Danny, run. This bitch has you by the balls, Malone thinks. You're trapped. If she puts out the word that you're a rat, they'll all come after you. The job, the Chaminos, the motherfuckers in City Hall. You're dead, Malone says. You spick cunt. Paz smiles at him. Spick cunt is famously good. That's why everyone wants them some. Give me cops. On tape. She walks out. For Malone, the room is spinning. He controls himself enough to say to Odell, we had a deal.
We're not asking for your partners, Odell says. Just get us one or two other guys. There have to be cops even you think are over the line, Denny.
Brutal cops, cops we need to get off the street.
I won't hurt my partners, Malone says.
This is you saving your partners, Odell says.
Do you think we're stupid? That we think you could pull off shit like Rivera by yourself? If we charge you with that, they go too. Russo and Montague. They're in your hands, Malone, Weintraub says.
Don't fumble.
Denny, Odell says. I like you. I don't think you're a bad guy. I think you're a good guy who's done some bad things. There's a way out of this for you and your partners. Work with us, and we'll work with you.
What about Paz?
You know she can't be privy to a deal like that, Odell says. Weintraub asks, why do you think she left? We have an understanding, Odell says.
If I give you one or two others, Malone says, I have your sacred word on the eyes of your children. You don't hurt my partners.
You have my word, Odell says.
How do you cross the line? Step by step. Chapter 16. Fat Teddy is on the move. Fast as Fat Teddy can move, anyway. From across Broadway in the liquor delivery truck, Malone watches him come down from the nail shop and hit the street, and he's still on the phone.
It's on,
Levin says, looking at his iPad screen. Teddy has used three phones to call the same Georgia cell phone, and now he's walking downtown on Broadway.
He just dialed a 212, Levin says. That's him telling Carter it's going, says Monty.
Where do you want to take him? Russo asks.
Wait, Malone says.
They stay parallel as Teddy crosses 158th. Then he turns right onto 157th and right again up Edward Morgan Place.
If he's going into Kennedy's Chicken, Monty says, it's too much of a stereotype for me.
They turn behind him. Did he make us? Russo asks.
No, Malone says.
Too much on his mind.
That's his car, Russo says. Outside the coffee shop?
Let's do it.
He dials Nasty Ass.
Do your thing.
Nasty hadn't wanted to be involved in this at all. Flat Ass balked at it.
Man, I could have got caught last time. I don't want to have to go back to Baltimore again.
You won't. Nasty tried another.
Ain't Carter protected by Torres?
Yeah, that's the fucking idea, Nasty.
You run the task force now?
Malone asked. They replaced Sykes with an Ichabod Crane-looking black junkie motherfucker? No one sent me the memo?
I'll decide where I work, asshole.
I'm just saying, don't be saying anything except you're gonna do what I ask you to do. So now Nasty's out on the street, and he calls 911.
I see a man with a gun.
Gives the address. It hits the radio, and Russo answers it.
Manhattan North Unit there. We got it.
They jump out of the truck, walk up behind Teddy, and mug him just before he gets to his car. Teddy ain't joking around this time. He got no mouth to give. This is serious business. Monty puts him against the car. Levin takes his phone. Malone says to Teddy, I swear to God, one fucking word. They hustle him back into the truck.
You have some shit-kicker friends coming up from the south?
Malone asks him. Teddy doesn't say anything. Monty climbs into the truck with a briefcase.
Look what I found.
He opens a case. Stacks of hundreds, fifties, twenties.
Save me the trouble, Teddy. How much?
65,
Teddy says. Malone laughs. Did you tell Carter 65? What's the real number?
50, motherfucker.
Russo takes 15 out of the case.
It's a sad, corrupt world.
Have you ever met Mantell? Malone asks. I'll just talk to him over the phone.
Why you want to know?
Here's how it's gonna go, Malone says. He holds up a sheaf of papers, the CI file he placed for Teddy. Either you become my CI right now, or this paperwork gets leaked to Raf Torres, who sells it to Carter.
You do that to me, Malone?
Oh, hell yes, Malone says. I'm doing it to you now, dumb fuck. Now what are you gonna do? Because I don't want your cracker friends getting hinky.
Well, I ain't never met Mantell.
Sign here. Here and here, Malone says, offering him a pen. Teddy signs.
Where are we gonna make the exchange? Malone asks.
Up by Highbridge Park.
The crackers know that?
Not yet.
Teddy's phone rings. Levin looks at Malone.
Georgia.
You have a shutdown code? Malone asks.
No.
Malone gestures to Levin, who holds the phone up to Teddy.
Where are you?
Teddy asks.
Harlem River Drive. Where am I going?
Teddy looks to Malone, who holds up a pad.
Dykeman, east of Broadway.
Teddy says.
There's a car service garage on the uptown side. Pull into the alley.
You got our money?
The fuck you think?
Teddy asks. Levin clicks off. Very good, Teddy, Malone says. Now call Carter. Tell him everything is copacetic.
What?
Good, Monty says. Teddy dials as Malone holds a CI statement up to remind him of the stakes.
Yeah, it's me,
Teddy says into the phone.
It's all good. 20 minutes, half hour maybe? All right.
He clicks off.
An Oscar-winning performance, says Russo.
You got boys waiting in Highbridge Park? Malone asks.
What you think?
So you didn't drive your fat ass up there, Malone says. You're gonna wait for these hillbillies, except they're not gonna show up.
You don't need me to make the buy?
Nah, Malone says. We have our own fat black man. I can hear you thinking, Teddy, so you think about this. If your new white friends don't show up at Dykeman, I file your paperwork with Carter.
What I tell him?
Tell him to watch the news, Malone says. And then tell him he shouldn't be doing business on my turf. Teddy gets out of the truck. Russo cuts up Teddy's 15K, hands Levin his share. Levin puts his hand up.
You guys do what you want. I didn't see anything. It's just, I don't do that.
It doesn't work that way, Russo says. You're either in or you're out.
If you don't take it, Montague says, we don't know that we can trust you to keep your mouth shut.
I'm not a rat, Levin says. Malone feels a twinge in his gut.
No one said you were,
Montague says.
It's just that you gotta have skin in the game, you feel me?
Take the money,
Russo says.
Give it to charity if you want,
Montague says.
Drop it in the poor box.
Send it to St. Jude's, Malone says.
Is that what you do?
Levin asks. Sometimes. Levin asks.
What happens if I don't take the money?
Russo grabs him by the shirt. You with IAB, Levin? You a field associate?
Get your hands off me.
Russo does, but he says, take your shirt off.
What?
Take your shirt off, Montague says.
Levin looks to Malone.
Malone nods.
Jesus Christ. Levin unbuttons his shirt, opens it for him.
Happy now?
Maybe it's under his balls, Russo says. Remember Lucci?
If you have anything under your balls, but you taint, Montague says, you better tell us now.
Peel him, Malone says. Levin shakes his head, unbuckles his belt, and slides his jeans down to his knees.
Would you like to look up my asshole, too?
Would you like us to? Russo asks. Levin pulls his jeans back up.
This is demeaning.
Nothing personal, Malone says. But you don't take money. We have to wonder what you're about.
I just want to be a cop.
Be one, then, Malone says. You just find Devon Carter $3,000.
That's the way it works?
That's the way it works. Levin picks the money up and counts it.
It's short.
The hell you mean? Russo asks.
15,000 divided by 4 is 3,070 and change, Levin says. This is 3,000 flat.
They laugh.
Russo says, well, we got us a real Jew on the team now.
When she goes to expenses, Malone says.
What expenses?
Levin asks.
What?
Russo asks.
You want a line item account?
Take Amy out to dinner, Malone says. Don't worry about it.
Buy us something nice, Montague says.
Not too nice, says Malone. Russo takes out a thick manila envelope and a pen.
Address this to yourself. Mail it. That way you don't have it on you.
They get back in the car, swing by a post office, then drive up to Dyckman.
What if Teddy warns them?
Levin asks. Then we're fucked, Malone says. But he gets on the horn to Sykes and advises him to get some backup units over to Highbridge Park. Gives him the make, model, and registration of Fat Teddy's car. Levin is nervous as a whore in church. Malone doesn't blame the kid. It's a huge score, a huge bust, the kind that makes careers, gets you a gold shield. And it was his motherfucking genius idea that put it together. Teddy's phone rings. Monty answers.
Where are you at?
Coming west on Dyckman.
I see you,
Monty says.
Yellow Penske truck?
That's us.
Bring it on in.
The rental truck pulls into the alley. A biker type, long hair, beard, leather cut with an ECMF rocker, gets out the passenger side with a pumped shotgun, swastika tat on his neck and an 88, numeric code for the Nazi salute, Heil Hitler. Win-win for this motherfucker, Malone thinks. Make some cash and hand the mud people tools to kill each other. Monty gets out of the liquor truck with his left hand raised and a briefcase in his right hand. Malone and Russo come out behind him, standing him back and to the side for open shooting lanes. Malone sees the biker get hinky.
I didn't expect white. We just want to make sure you're comfortable,
Monty says.
I don't know about this. Oh, there's a lot of black around you,
Monty says.
You just don't see them because it's night. Hold up.
The biker calls Teddy's number. He has it ring in Monty's pocket and relaxes a little.
Okay. Okay?
Monty says.
What you got for me?
The driver gets out, walks around, and opens the back of the truck. Malone follows Monty and looks inside as the biker starts to open crates. There are enough guns in there to keep homicide busy for 2 years. Revolvers, automatics, pump shotguns, and automatic rifles, an AK, three AR-15s, including a Bushmaster.
It's all there,
the biker says. Monty swings the briefcase onto the tailgate and opens it.
50 large. You want to count it?
Yeah, he does. He counts the stacks of marked, registered bills.
On the money.
Malone and Russo start to offload the guns and carry them back to the liquor truck.
Let Mantel know,
Monty says. We'll buy as much as he can send. The biker smiles.
As long as you're using them on other people of color.
Monty can't help himself.
There may be cops. Works for me.
Yeah? Does that work for you? Malone thinks. We'll see how it works for you when some CO is beating your kidneys into jello, you meth-smoking, jerky-eating, cousin-fucking shit-kicker. I'd do it right now for you if I didn't want to hand this Buster Sykes into force. To finish offloading.
You need directions?
Monty asks the driver. Monty thinks of everything. Sykes has a location covered from all compass points, but this will give him a heads up on which way the truck is likely to head.
Back the way we came, I guess,
the driver says.
Or just go straight up Dykeman here to the Henry Hudson, south of the GW Bridge, then 95 back to Dixie.
We'll find our own way, the biker says.
Motherfucker,
Monty says, shaking his head.
If we was gonna rip you, we'd do it right here, not chasing you down the highway.
Mantel will be in touch.
Heil Hitler.
The Penske truck backs out and, true to paranoid form, turns right onto Dykeman to drive all the way across the city before it can get back on a highway. Malone gets on the horn. Suspect is coming east on Dykeman.
We have a visual,
Sykes says. Levin's grinning.
Wait for it, Malone says.
Then it goes off, sirens yelling. Malone and Levin walk out on the street and see the red flashes as the sector cars move in.
Well, Malone says, there are two mothers at least who won't be getting fucked tonight.
Levin, that was some real police work you did.
Thanks.
Seriously,
Malone says, you saved some lives tonight. A sector car comes down and Sykes gets out of the back seat. Full uniform, freshly shaved, camera ready.
What do we have, Sergeant?
Come on. He leads Sykes back to the truck. Sykes looks at the weapons.
Jesus Christ.
You call McGivern? Malone asks. Sykes doesn't bring McGivern in on this from the jump. The inspector will cockblock his career until he pulls the pin.
No, Sergeant, I'm an idiot,
Sykes says.
He's on his way.
He's still looking at the guns. Malone knows what it means to him. Sure, it's great for his career, but it's more than that. Like the rest of them, Sykes has seen the bodies, the blood, the families, the funerals. For a few seconds, Malone almost likes the man. And for himself, he feels like a cop again, instead of a rat. A cop taking care of his business, taking care of his people, because tonight there'll be less death and suffering in the kingdom of Malone. Another car rolls up, and McGivern gets out.
This is fine work, gentlemen,
he hollers.
Fine work, Captain. It's a great night to be a New York City police officer, isn't it?
He walks up closer to Sykes.
You seized the buy money, didn't you?
Yes, sir,
Sykes says. More cars roll in. Crime scene people, task force guys. They start taking photographs and vouchering the seized weapons before they take them into the house, where they'll be laid out for a morning press conference. After the paperwork is done, Sykes surprises everyone by announcing that the first round down at the Dublin house is on him. First implies second, which implies third, and after that, who's counting? Somewhere between 5 and 6, Malone finds himself sitting next to Sykes at the bar.
If someone asked me,
Sykes says,
to name the best and worst cops I've ever worked with, I would answer Denny Malone.
Malone lifts his glass to him. Sykes lifts his, and they toss him back.
Never seen you out of uniform before, Malone says. I did 3 years UC in the 7-8,
Sykes says.
Would you believe that?
No, can't see it.
I had dreads.
Get the fuck out of here.
Hand of God,
Sykes says.
That was good work tonight, Malone. I hate to think what would happen if those guns hit the street.
Devon Carter ain't gonna be happy.
Fuck Carter.
Malone starts to laugh.
What?
Sykes asks.
I was just thinking about this time, Malone says. Monty and Russo and Billy O and me and about 6 other off-duty detectives are sitting in this bar and this black kid, no offense, walks through the door with a gun, yells, it's a hold-up.
World's dumbest stick-up guy, right? Must have been a first-timer because he looked about 19 and he's scared to death. So he points a gun
and Mike, behind the bar, just looks at him. And all of a sudden, this poor kid has probably 12 guns pointed back at him, and all these cops are laughing and yelling, "Get the fuck out of here!" And the kid spins like he's in a cartoon and runs out the door. We don't even follow him. We just go back to our drinks.
But you didn't shoot?
He was a kid, Malone says. I mean, what kind of dumbass sticks up a cop bar?
A desperate one, I guess. Difference between you and me?
Sykes says.
I'd have gone after him.
A party is going on around them. Monty is dancing to the music all on his own. Russo and Emma Flynn are trading shots. Levin is table surfing. Babyface is trashing a bunch of plain clothes at beer pong. Malone's heart is breaking. He's going to betray these people. He's going to give them cops. Laying a 20 on the bar, Malone says, "I'd better go."
Denny, last call, Malone?
Sykes asks.
Yeah. I better go before I get any drunker, start talking, spilling my guilty guts, slobbering all over the bar, and telling everyone what a piece of shit I am.
Levin sees him get up.
Malone! You can't leave yet!
Malone waves to him.
Malone!
Levin yells. He raises his beer mug.
Everyone! Everybody! Hey, y'all motherfuckers! Listen up! He's gonna feel this tomorrow,
Sykes says.
Jews can't drink, Malone says.
Levin looks like the freaking Statue of Liberty with his mug raised above his head like a torch.
Ladies and gentlemen of the force, I give you Sergeant Denny Malone, the best motherfucking, ball-breaking, perp-busting badass on the streets of our fair city, the king of Manhattan North. Long live the king!
The cops take up the chanting. Yell. Long live the king. Long live the king. Long live the king. Sykes smiles at Malone.
You're an all right guy, Captain, Malone says. I don't like you very much, but you're an all right guy.
Take care of these people, okay?
That's my job,
Sykes says, looking around the bar.
I love these fucking people.
Me too, Malone thinks. He walks out. He doesn't belong there anymore. Doesn't belong at Claudette's either. He goes back to his apartment, polishes off what's left of a bottle of Jameson's by himself. Chapter 17. The press conference looks like open mic night at the Chuckle Hut. Classic, Malone thinks. The weapons are laid out on tables, carefully labeled, looking lethal and beautiful. A line of suits and brass stand on the dais, waiting their turn at the microphone. In addition to Sykes, who doesn't even look hungover, and McGivern, you got Neely, the chief of detectives, Isidore, the chief of patrol, police commissioner Brady, the deputy commissioner, the mayor, and for reasons that passeth Malone's understanding, the Reverend Cornelius. McGivern says a few words of departmental self-congratulations and then introduces Sykes, who speaks in technical terms about the operation, the weapons seized, and how proud he is of the many task force personnel who work together to achieve this outcome. He yields the mic to the commissioner, who broadens the congratulations to include the entire department and makes a point of going on for a while just to make the mayor wait. When his honor finally gets the mic, he stretches the credit out to include every suit in or around City Hall, especially and including himself, and talks about how the department and the administration working together makes this a safer city for everybody. And then he introduces the good reverend. Malone already felt like throwing up, but now he really feels like throwing up as Cornelius preaches about the community, nonviolence, and the root economic causes of said violence, and how the community needs programs, not pogroms. And nobody knows what the fuck that means. And then dances a tightrope as he tries to urge the police to do more while warning them not to do too much. All in all, Malone thinks, it's a great performance. Even U.S. Attorney Isabel Paz, representing the Southern District of New York, which has done so much to combat interstate weapons trafficking, seems to enjoy the show. When Malone's phone rings, it's Paz, and he can see her across the crowded lobby.
Don't think this is going to help you, shitbird. I still want cops. Now more than ever, right?
Malone asks, looking at her.
The commissioner was looking very mayoral, I thought.
Cops. On tape. Now. Click.
Torres confronts him in the locker room at Manhattan North.
You and me need to talk,
Torres says.
Okay,
says Malone.
Not here.
They walk outside and across the street, into the treed courtyard outside St. Mary's.
You motherfucker,
Torres says.
Good,
Malone thinks. The angrier the better. Anger makes Torres careless. He makes mistakes. He gets right up on Malone.
Get out of my face, Malone says.
I should kick your fucking ass. I'm not one of your girls. Torres' voice goes to a rasp. The fuck you doing? Hitting that shipment on Dykeman?
That's my turf. You were supposed to stay out of the Heights.
Carter made the deal for my turf. You just gave your turf to Castillo, asshole, Torres says.
What's Carter supposed to do without guns?
Die? I had a piece of that deal, Malone. A finder's fee. What, we give refunds now?
You don't fuck with my money, Malone.
Okay, okay, Malone says. Then, feeling like a piece of shit, he makes his pitch. Get Paz what she wants. What's it gonna take to make this right? What's your piece? Torres calms down a little. Then he sticks his neck in the noose.
15. Plus the three Carter's not paying me this month now that we fucked him.
You want the sweat off my dick, too?
No, you can keep that,
Torres says.
When do I get my money?
Meet me in the parking lot, Malone says. Malone goes back there, takes 18K out of the console, and puts it in an envelope. Torres shows up a few minutes later and slides into the passenger seat. In the closeness of the car, Malone can smell the man. The stale coffee breath, the cigarette smoke on his clothes, the too strong cologne. Torres says,
so?
It's not too late, Malone thinks. Not too late to back off from hurting a brother cop, even a low motherfucker like Torres. Until he takes the money, they got nothing on Ralph. Just him talking some bullshit. You cross this line, there's no going back.
Yo, Malone,
Torres is asking.
You got something for me or what?
Yeah, I got something for you, Malone thinks. He slides him the envelope.
Here's your money.
Torres puts the envelope in his pocket.
Do me a favor? Jerk yourself off. Lose this hard on you got for Carter. Believe me, Castillo is worse.
Carter is history, Malone says. He just don't know it yet. Don't cross me again, Denny. Kiss my skinny Irish ass. Torres gets out of the car. Malone opens his shirt and checks the recording device. It's on. It got the exchange. Torres is a walking dead man. And so are you, Malone thinks. The man you used to be doesn't exist anymore. Then he drives downtown to deliver the tape to Odell. 15, 20 times on the way, he thinks about just dumping the tape and driving away. But if I do, he thinks, I just drop Russo and Monty into my shit. So if it's a choice between them and Torres...
Weintraub pops it into the machine right away, and Malone listens to,
the fuck you doing hitting that shipment? On Dykeman? That's my turf. You're supposed to stay out of the Heights.
Carter made the deal for my turf.
You just gave your turf to Castillo, asshole. What's Carter supposed to do without guns?
Die?
I had a piece of that deal, Malone. A finder's fee.
What, we give refunds now?
You don't fuck with my money, Malone.
Okay, okay. What's it gonna take to make this right? What was your piece?
Way to be, Malone, Weintraub says. You're getting the hang of this.
15. Plus the three Carter's not paying me this month now that we fucked him.
You want the sweat off my dick, too?
Nice touch, Weintraub says.
No, you can keep that.
When do I get my money? Did you give him the designated bills? Weintraub asks.
Yeah, we got him,
Weintraub says. Odell says,
good job, Malone.
Fuck you.
Our boy's feeling all guilty because he flipped on a drug-dealing cop,
Weintraub says. Torres deserves everything he gets. Which is what? Malone asks.
We're going to take him to a nice farm in the country where he'll be happy playing with all the other crooked cops,
Weintraub says.
The hell you think is going to happen?
That's enough, Odell says. Denny, don't open your mouth to me. I know how you're feeling.
No, you don't.
Malone walks out of the room.
His footsteps echo in the empty hallway. Jesus Christ, he thinks. You just did it. You hurt a brother cop. You can tell yourself you didn't have a choice. You had to do it, right? For your family, for Claudette, for your partners. Yeah, you can tell yourself that, and it's all true, but none of it changes the fact that you just hurt a brother cop. Then the hallway starts tilting. His legs feel unsteady, and all of a sudden, he's leaning against the wall, grabbing at it as if it can keep him from falling. Then he bends over and puts his face in his hands. For the first time since his brother died, he sobs. Chapter 18. Claudette looks lovely. White on black. A tight sheath of a white dress shows off her figure and her dark skin. Gold hoop earrings, red lipstick, her hair up in a 1940s retro do with a white flower. Stunning. Heart-cracking, blood-heating, eye-popping, beautiful. Malone falls in love with her anew. They're having a real date. She was right, he decided. For whatever fucked up reason, he'd been hiding her, leaving her alone with her doubt and her addiction. Fuck everyone. If the rednecks on the job don't like it, fuck them. And if the brothers think it means he's going to cut them some slack, they'll learn quickly enough they're wrong. And there's something else. He needs her. After setting up a brother cop, even an asshole like Torres, he needs her. So he picked up the phone and called. Was a little surprised she didn't just hang up on him when he said, "This is Sergeant Malone of Manhattan North." There was a little pause before she said, "What can I do for you, detective?" He could tell from her voice she was clean. "I know this is last minute," he said, "but I have reservations tonight at Jean-Georges, and no one merciful enough to have dinner with, an insensitive, neglectful jerk like myself. And while I'm pretty sure a woman such as yourself already has plans, I thought I'd take a chance and ask if there's any possibility you would have dinner with me." He endured a long silence before she said, "A table at Jean-Georges is hard to get." Fucking A, he thought. He'd had to remind the maitre d' of a certain incident he'd quieted down before it made page 6. "I just told him there was a chance, just a chance, that the most beautiful and charming lady in New York might grace their establishment, and they fell all over themselves." "You're laying it on thick." "Subtlety is not my strong suit," Malone said. "How about it?" Another long silence before she said, "I'd be delighted." He takes her to Jean-Georges because she likes French things. Zagat rated, 3 Michelin stars, expensive, impossible to get a reservation unless you're a celebrity detective. But it's Malone, even though he's dressed in a nice suit, who's a little nervous in the fancy place. Not Claudette. She looks like she was born there. The waiter thinks so, too, addresses most of his questions and comments to her, and she handles it like she's been doing it her whole life. She quietly suggests wines and dishes, and Malone goes with them. "How do you know all this?" he asks her, picking his way through the toasted egg yolk with caviar and herbs, which is actually a lot better than he thought it would be. "Believe it or not," she says, "you're not the first man I ever dated. I've been south of 110th, gosh, 5 or 6 times, maybe even 7. It feels like a fucking idiot. "Go ahead, squeeze my shoes. I deserve it." "Yes, you do," she says. "But I'm having a wonderful time, baby. Thank you for bringing me here. It's beautiful." "You're beautiful." "See, you're doing better already." Malone picks the Maine lobster, Claudette, the smoked squab. "Isn't that a pigeon?" Malone asks. "It is a pigeon," she says. "Didn't you ever want revenge?" They don't talk about the smack, her slip, her jonesing. She's feeling better now, looking better. He thinks maybe she's over it. For dessert, they take a sampling of chocolate tastings, during which Claudette says, "So, this is our first real date in a long time." The key word there is first. "With our schedules," Claudette says, "it's hard to find time." "I might start working a little less," Malone says. "Take a little more time off."
"I'd like that."
"Yeah?"
"Very much," she says. "But we don't have to always do
You know, this. It's nice doing this.
I just want time with you, baby, Claudette says.
Malone gets up to use the men's, but instead he goes to the woman at the hostess stand and tells her he wants a real bill, bust out retail, because there are some things you get comp for, other things you pay for. You take your girl out, you pay for it.
The hostess says,
the manager said,
I know, Malone says, and I appreciate it, but I'd like a real bill.
The real bill arrives, he pays it, leaves a nice tip, and pulls a chair out for Claudette. I thought you might like to go to smoke. Leah Delari is here tonight. Malone doesn't know who that is, just that she's a singer. He went to the website and looked it up.
I'd love that, Claudette says. I love her.
But you don't like jazz. This is your night. The Smoke Jazz and Supper Club is up on 106th and Broadway, back on Malone's turf. It's small, only about 50 seats, but Malone already called a reserve spot in case she wanted to go. They get a table for two. Delaria sings standards in front of a bass, drums, piano, and saxophone quartet. Claudette feigns astonishment.
A white woman who can sing, my, my.
Racist.
Just keeping it real, baby.
Between songs, Delaria looks down at Claudette and asks,
is he nice to you, darling?
Claudette nods.
Very nice.
Delaria looks at Malone.
You'd better be.
She's so beautiful.
I might just take her away from you.
Then she launches into Come Rain or Come Shine.
I'm gonna love you like nobody's loved you. Come rain or come shine. Happy together, unhappy together. Come rain or come shine.
There's a little stir in the crowd as Trey comes in with a posse. Delaria gives him a nod of acknowledgement as Trey goes to his table. Then the hip-hop mogul spots Malone and then Claudette and gives Malone a nod of respect. Malone nods back.
Do you know him?
Claudette asks. I do some work for him from time to time, Malone says. And now the word will be out everywhere that badass Denny Malone is dating a sister.
You want to meet him?
Malone asks.
Not really, Claudette says. I'm not so much into hip-hop.
Malone knows what's going to happen next, and it does. A bottle of Cristal arrives at the table, courtesy of Trey.
What kind of work do you do for him? Claudette asks.
Security. Delaria changes over to You Don't Know What Love Is.
Billie Holiday,
Claudette says. She gets lost in it. Malone looks over at Trey, who's looking back at him, reevaluating him, trying to figure out who the guy is that he's seeing now.
I get it, Malone thinks.
I'm trying to do the same thing. The white dress slides off her like rain flowing down obsidian. Her lips are full and warm, her neck musky. After they make love and she falls asleep, he lies awake and looks out a window and remembers the words of the song. Until you faced each dawn with sleepless eyes, you don't know what love is.